This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Who is looking out for America's low-income children? A new study in the journal Health Affairs finds that a kid born in the U.S. has a 70% higher chance of dying before adulthood than kids born in other wealthy democracies. 70% higher. Add to that the viability of CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, is in doubt. According to Kaiser Health News, some states may run out of money for CHIP as soon as January 21st of this year. How are we ensuring that America's children, especially from low-income families, can have a bright future too? Let's begin with the status of CHIP. Joining us in studio to discuss it is my colleague, WAMU's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Selena has covered the effects of the uncertainty surrounding CHIP in Virginia. Selena, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We asked you for your thoughts on the insecure future of CHIP in many states. Here is what some of you left in our inbox.
This is Nancy, St. Louis, Missouri. I vote yes. As all nurses and physicians know, we have to act in accordance of something called the public good. So yes, for the CHIP, I would pay more taxes to provide health care for low income and children of low income who cannot afford otherwise.
Hi, this is Sabrina from Illinois. I think a lot of people don't understand CHIP, and we need to figure out a way to make them understand. CHIP is not just welfare for people not working or whatever their vendettas are. It is children, and it is children like my daughter. My husband and I both work full-time. My daughter has had to have multiple surgeries just in 2017 alone, and I've added it up, and if it wasn't for CHIP, we would have to come up with $20,000 out of pocket. We are the gray area. 9 million other kids are the gray area that has been abandoned by our government.
Thanks to everybody who shared your thoughts with us. You can continue to do so as we discuss CHIP for this segment. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Selena, why don't we start with that gray area? The status of CHIP affects kids in that area. Can you define for us, first of all, who exactly it is that CHIP covers?
Right. So this is for families who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, which takes care of like the lowest income people in our country, but don't make enough money to be able to afford insurance in the private marketplace. And so these are people who are low to middle income. Sometimes families that have a lot of kids really can't afford to cover them. That was true of a family that I spoke to in Front Royal, Virginia. This was a single income family with four little boys, and CHIP was really the only way that they could insure their kids.
How does the status of CHIP on the national stage kind of compare to what you saw in Virginia? Is every state kind of facing the exact same struggle, or is it different from state to state?
Every state is in a really difficult situation right now because funding expired at the end of September and hasn't been renewed. There was just a little bit of stopgap funding that came through at the end of December. But what it does in the states is a little bit different, depending on whether states chose to expand Medicaid to give kids CHIP or created a separate program. So in Virginia, about half of the people who use CHIP funding are on Medicaid. And in that case, the state has a budget problem without this new funding, but the kids aren't at risk of losing coverage. So about 68,000 kids in Virginia are on the FAMIS program, which is like a separate program just for kids covered by CHIP. And if that funding doesn't come through, then that program will shut down. And that's true of most states. And there's actually a study out this morning from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families that says 11 states, Arizona, Connecticut, D.C., Florida, Hawaii, Louisiana, Minnesota, Nevada, New York, Ohio, and Washington might run out of funding at the end of February, which means that they might be sending out notices come February 1st that the program is going to freeze enrollment, that kids are going to have to look for alternative sources of insurance really quickly. quite soon.
And just to be clear, I heard you mention D.C. and Washington State.
Washington State, yes.
Gotcha. Then just to be a little bit clearer about CHIP, CHIP is not, you don't walk around with a CHIP card in your pocket. CHIP provides support so states can provide the service.
Right. It's just the name. It stands for Children's Health Insurance Program. It's the name of a program that was created in 1997 in Congress. It has to be periodically renewed, but it always has been until just recently.
Let's hear from one of the families that you spoke to in Virginia. You spoke to Lindsay Feaster, who's a mother of four kids in Virginia. Ms. Feaster had just received a letter from the state of Virginia warning that her kids might lose their insurance as early as this month.
It's not feasible for you to afford to cover them privately.
No, it's not even feasible to afford to cover myself privately. Right now, I've been uninsured for the past 3 years.
Selena Simmons-Duffin, how much does Lindsay's story reflect what you've heard from other Virginians, particularly the part about being uninsured for so many years?
Right. So she can't afford to cover herself. And her husband's insurance is partially subsidized through work. But she said that to cover her and her four boys would cost $2,000 a month. They just don't have that. And so I think that she reflects the problem across the country in the sense that there aren't really alternatives for people to turn to. If the CHIP programs start shutting down, there's not there's not a backup program. You know, most people won't qualify for Medicaid, and most people will continue to not be able to afford options like the exchanges or private insurance.
We're speaking to WAMU and NPR reporter Selena Simmons-Duffin about CHIP funding and the effects that would come with disrupting or ending this program. And we'd love to hear from you. Again, we're only discussing CHIP for this first segment, so we'd love your questions and your stories right away. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Doug is listening from Virginia, and he writes, "The one question I ask myself every time I hear about Congress not renewing funding for CHIP is, why can't individual states fund CHIP? Why is it presented as though only the federal government can provide health insurance for low-income children? Surely each state could provide this coverage if they wanted to. And if they choose not to do so, why should they rely on the federal government, and by extension, taxpayers of other states, to come up with the money that they are unwilling to come up with themselves?"
I'm not sure if I can really answer that question, but I do know that in this situation we're in right now, states were not expecting this money to go away. So all of their budgets for this fiscal year assumed that this money was going to come through from the federal government. If they were going to make alternative plans, they just didn't have a chance to do that because the assumption was that Congress would pass this funding. They always have. So if there was going to be a completely new structure for, you know, how this was funded on the state level, then they would just have needed, I think, some warning to be able to arrange that.
And it's also probably worth picking apart part of what Doug wrote, which is surely each state could provide this coverage if they wanted to. That may not necessarily be true. I mean, Virginia is a different kind of a state. There's this tremendous cluster of population and wealth in Northern Virginia, closer to Washington, D.C. So maybe if Virginia had to fall back on its own funding a little more, maybe it's one of the states that could kind of bear the burden a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, but I do know that Oregon, for one, has said that they will use state funding to cover CHIP so that they don't have to shut down the program. And their assumption is that Congress eventually will pass funding for CHIP and they'll get reimbursed. So that's kind of a bet that they're making.
Dallas is listening in Pittsburgh, and Dallas writes, "Farm families need CHIP. They do not have employer insurance. I wonder if the Farm Bureau Convention folks told Trump this when he was there," referring to the president's recent address to the Farm Bureau Association. David wrote on our Facebook page, "It's considered a commercial plan, but it had large deductibles, so of course they prefer the government-supplied health coverage. I have to pay $800 a month for coverage for my kids with a $6,000 deductible." Huh? I don't get a choice. Guess I have to pay for those that don't want to have to pay large deductibles. Seems about right. Selena, you spoke to Linda Nablo, who's the chief deputy director of the Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services. Here's part of what Linda had to say.
I don't think you can find a senator or a representative who would say they are opposed to CHIP. If you ask any one of them, and they'll tell you how valuable it is in their state and what a supporter they are and what a good program it is, and surely they're going to fund it. And yet, here we sit.
Selena, what about that? The political support for CHIP, regardless of what the policy might turn into What does that look like?
Well, it's really popular. It has support from Democrats and Republicans. There's a bill called the KIDS Act, which stands for Keep Kids Insurance Dependable and Secure Act, that is in both the House and Senate. It actually was introduced in the Senate by Orrin Hatch, who was one of the authors of CHIP back in the 90s. And it does have a lot of support. It is really popular, as Linda Nablow said. But there is some disagreement about how to pay for it. And that seems to be the holdup. And in addition to just attention on other priorities in Congress. But as Linda Nablow said, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And I think that administrators like Linda Nablow are in a really tough spot because they really do believe that there is will and, there is the political will in Congress to pass it. It just hasn't happened yet. So they're in a holding pattern and really in a tough situation.
And speaking of those other priorities, J.A. Starr tweeted, sick kids ensure sick adults if not helped and taken care of. Why are billions spent on our military and our children are allowed to get sick and die? And Eric tweeted, my family relies on CHIP to provide affordable coverage for my daughter. Losing it would place more burden on us, but lower income families are really going to struggle. Before we let you go, Selena, we're really short on time, but what happens now? What's the next step?
Well, now we wait to see what Congress is going to do. I think states are making a bet that maybe they can hang on a little bit longer and maybe Congress will come through by the end of the month and they'll have some security that they can keep this program going.
That's WAMU's Selena Simmons-Duffin. You'll find more of our reporting online at WAMU.org. Selena, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we dive into an intriguing economic proposal to reduce income inequality in the U.S. It's called a baby bond, to start American kids on the right foot after 18 years of their life. We'll debate that idea in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. So we just discussed the consequences of CHIP funding falling through the cracks for America's youth. Another proposal to help low-income kids is this idea that's come to be known as baby bonds. It would involve a significant fund for American children at birth that would allow them to use those funds solely on asset-building ventures. And we'll explain that a little more in a minute. This idea has gotten some traction from political candidates in the past. Currently, it's functioning on smaller scales in some states. Joining us from NPR in New York is Derek Hamilton, a professor of economics and policy and the director of the doctoral program in public and urban policy at the New School. Recently, he proposed a revamped idea on baby bonds this past weekend at the American Economic Association's conference in Philadelphia. Professor Hamilton, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
Joining us here in studio is Véronique de Rougy, an economist and senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Previously, she was a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Véronique, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And also here in studio, Michael Sheridan is a professor and founder and director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University in St. Louis. He is a pioneer in the field of baby bonds, having researched the idea for decades now. Professor Sheridan, glad to have you with us.
Very good to be here.
We also welcome your thoughts about baby bonds, especially as you hear more about the idea, whether you think it would be a valuable endeavor for leveling the playing field, what questions you have, what critiques you have, or what you are seeing that works in preparing young people for the future, regardless of their socioeconomic status. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. I wonder, Professor Sheridan, just to bridge out of the conversation we had on CHIP, if we could just acknowledge for a second how very thorny this whole issue is, and that it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like there are no perfect plans, perfect solutions to help lower income children close the gaps with wealthier children. It seems like these various ideas, no matter how well-intentioned they are always going to run up against reality. This just seems like an inherently thorny thing to try to attempt.
Well, I think that's right, Joshua. This is always and probably always will be a challenge. We have, though, generated a lot more inequality in the last couple of decades than we have had at some times in American history. And this is really a crucial issue because it's in all of our interest that we raise all of our children to be as effective, as educated, and productive as possible.
Professor Hamilton, let me ask you about your proposal. You and your fellow economist, William Darity at Duke University, have put this proposal together with baby bonds. First of all, define for us what exactly a baby bond would be under your proposal.
So technically, it is not a bond, but rather a trust account that's set up at birth. We use baby bond for alliteration and political purposes of just labeling it. Mm. But it would be an account that's set up at birth that would grow in a federal trust and be available for a newborn when they become a young adult and restricted towards some asset-enhancing endeavor. And those endeavors would include a down payment on a home, seed capital to start a new business, or financing a debt-free college education. There could be other ways in which we offer asset enhancement, but those would be the three major ways. The accounts at birth would not be one single dollar amount, but would be seeded based largely in part on the familial position in which you're born. So those that are born into the most wealth-poor family or the lowest income families would receive the highest bond, the highest trust account at birth, whereas those that are born into more wealthy families, they would be included in the program, just like Social Security, but the level of endowment would not be as large. And then I'll just say this really quick. The intent of the program is to adjust for the fact that at birth, some people are better positioned to have better life outcomes and socioeconomic outcomes simply because of the familial position in which they're born.
I want to make sure that we're clear that you're saying that a so-called baby bond is not a literal government bond at all. I think for purposes of just simplicity, we'll continue using that term baby bond, but I hear you when you say that it's not quite the same as like a typical, like I would go buy a U.S. savings bond. It's not quite the same as that, right?
That's correct.
Okay. How much might these so-called baby bonds be worth? How many dollars are we talking?
So we're talking about a substantial amount. We're talking about the average account being about $20,000, and the accounts rising upwards to $50,000 or $60,000 for those that are born into the families that are least well off.
How much would the families that are most well off be getting, roughly?
They would get a nominal account of, say, $500.
So everyone would get something, but some would get far more.
Exactly.
So I'm born in the United States. Say the baby bonds bill passes in 2020. I'm born in 2021. I would turn 18 in the year 2039. What happens? Do I go to Wells Fargo and they hand me a debit card? Like, what happens then?
Well, at that point, there would be an agency set up, and you would have to make a request to receive your account. But that request would be granted only if the money is going to be used towards one of the activities that we described before. You know, some people have talked about, well, why not just give people the money? Why do you have that paternalistic aspect on the program where the accounts are restricted towards some asset-enhancing endeavor? The reason for that restriction is, you know, take myself, for example. I was not born into the most wealthy family. And when I became a young adult, I would have had care obligations. So simply due to altruistic motives, I would not have been able to self-invest because I would have had to fund for people's health or poverty conditions that were in my extended family. So in a lot of ways, having the restriction on the account towards some asset-enhancing endeavor does two things. It protects people even from their good motives of trying to help out other individuals so that they are strictly focused on self-investment. And then the second part is that the accounts are really intended to address the wealth gap or asset differences, which is a field that was built up by Michael Sheridan and really, really changed the way we think about inequality and poverty to go just beyond income to really start thinking about assets. So the accounts really are honing in on trying to make sure everybody has asset security.
We're speaking to Professor Derek Hamilton from the New School in New York about this idea of what we are colloquially referring to as a baby bond, alongside Professor Michael Sheradin of Washington University in St. Louis and Veronique de Rougy of the Mercatus Institute at George Mason University. Veronique, I know that there are a number of very smart, critical questions about this idea, some of which we're getting from our listeners. We welcome more of your questions as well. But before we start to pick the idea apart, Professor Sheradin, this idea has been around in various forms for a while. Does what we heard from Professor Hamilton kind of resemble the core of the idea over time? Has the idea evolved? Can you just kind of give us a sense of the arc of this notion of a baby bond?
Yeah, there are countries that have more experience with this than we do, and I think a lot of times in the United States we don't pay enough attention to what's happening in other countries. We don't have to reinvent everything, and I think that's really important. And also, this has moved beyond the idea stage, and I think it's really important to recognize that we have a body of practical evidence about what can happen if you set up accounts for children and money accumulates in them. So we, for example, have been running an experiment, a randomly assigned experiment, treatment and control group in the state of Oklahoma for the last 10 years across the full population. So we have subsamples of African Americans and Native Americans and Hispanics. We have very good data on if kids have an account and their assets accumulating versus kids who not and what happens to them. So we have real evidence about, one, that you can actually set this up, you can put it in place, it's not just a pie-in-the-sky idea, and two, that there are effects on families and children that appear to be very positive.
Veronique de Rougy, what would you say are the one or two biggest critiques of this idea if someone was to consider implementing it? Where are the potential flaws and pitfalls?
Well, I guess maybe the first one, even before judging the merit of the idea of like giving a bunch of money, even in a restricted fashion to 18 years old, I guess the first one is a fiscal reality. Is like, how are you going to be paying for this? I mean, I know that this idea of a bond, I mean, not literally a bond, but is kind of we've had other experiment with this, like with Social Security. We have already like an entitlement system that is not on sound financial grounds. We already, like for Social Security alone, benefits are on track to be cut by 25% in 2035 because the trust funds are drying out. And by then, by law, you know, the benefits will be cut. And I see no political will to address these pressing issues with program we already have and we've had for a long time. So I just think that the big one is the fiscal reality independently of the merits of the idea.
That sounds a lot like exactly what Karen wrote us from St. Louis. Karen writes, this sounds great, but the government has proven not to be trustworthy with our Social Security contributions. So why on earth would we be trusting them with this money? And our friend Harry, who's listening in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, writes, who issues the bonds and thus who's on the hook for paying off the coupon clippers? Don't we, the people, have enough bond indebtedness as it is? Professor Hamilton, what about that? Where would the money come from?
Well, we already spend a great deal of money to try to incentivize asset development in this country. And we do so with tax savings and tax subsidies to things like mortgage interest deductions, differences in the way we tax capital gains and dividends, and then also not taxing capital appreciation at death. So we spend a lot of money already with our tax code to the tune of well over $500 billion. So the dollar amount is not the issue, but rather how it is distributed. So who reaps the benefit of that tax code that we have, or the tax policy that we have? The wealthy. The bottom 60% of earners receive about 12% of that $500 billion endowment, whereas the top 20% receive about 70% of that. So baby bonds would only be a fraction of that dollar amount. We're talking about something in the tune of $80 to $90 billion a year, which amounts to about 2% of federal spending, current federal spending. And of that asset building budget, it would only amount to about 20%. I mean, it's noteworthy that we just passed a tax bill, which is going to increase the deficit by $1 trillion. And, you know, people, it's part of the discourse, but there was political will to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about is a policy that really is going to provide everybody the opportunity for asset security. And in the scheme of what it can do, I'd say it's relatively cheap.
Veronique?
I mean, there's no debate from me that there's a lot of tax breaks in the tax code that should be going away and are benefit high-income earners. But I can guarantee you that there is no political will, not just on the Republican side, but also on the Democrat side. And the other thing that is actually problematic is like, yes, let's talk about the deficit. Even before we take under account the tax code, the tax reform that was put in place, we are on schedule to increase the deficit in the next 10 years by $900 billion. We're going to reach, outside of war, outside of a recession, we're going to reach $1.5 trillion deficit by 2027. Our debt is increasing. Again, there are a lot of problems with the current entitlement spending where we don't know where the money is going to come from and the solution is going to be more borrowing. And so I think it is important to realize that a project that, independently of the merit of the project, that is planned on basically committing to more debt, because this is what it is. It's not as if the government is going to be putting some actual money in this. It's going to be issuing the promise of a payment 18 years down the road, which is going to have to be paid by borrowing more money, is a fiscal reality that no one should ignore.
I wonder if we could touch on the political aspect of this, mm-hmm. the political will question. I mean, this idea has come up politically before. Hillary Clinton raised mm-hmm. it when she ran for president the first time. Rudy Giuliani kind of sniped back at Mrs. Clinton on the campaign trail in 2007. Mrs. Clinton floated the idea of a $5,000 bond for each child. Here is part of what Rudy Giuliani said on the campaign trail back in 2007.
Last week, she promised a $5,000 bond for every new child born in the United States. I'm wondering the detail, how this $5,000 bond for every child is going to work. Is it going to include every single child born in the United States? Suppose millionaires have children. Is it going to be means tested? If it is going to be means tested, what's the new bureaucracy you're going to create to do this? Now, why do these questions occur to me? They occur to me because I ran a city.
That's Rudy Giuliani speaking on the campaign trail back in 2007 in response to Hillary Clinton's proposal for a so-called baby bond. Professor Sheridan, what about this? The politics of this seem to be, as we know, where a lot of interesting ideas go to die, especially in the details, the new bureaucracy, how you're going to get this thing done. Is it going to be means tested? It seems like just politically, this is an easy idea to kill.
I don't fully agree with that. I think we are in a time of, you know, pretty partisan politics, so it's easy to have these political arguments. But the historical discussion of accounts for all children has come from Republicans and Democrats. Various versions of this over time. Politically it's a little bit difficult now, but we have to have a little bit longer term perspective if we're testing a policy idea and trying to put it in place and getting it ready to put in place when the time is right to do that. I'd also like to reinforce Professor Hamilton's point that this doesn't have to add to the deficit at all. We have several hundred billion dollars a year in asset building that is going pretty much to the top half of the income distribution. So if that was just distributed somewhat fairly, then we could have baby bonds and we could be accumulating assets in lots of families that would make the country better off in the long run.
We got to pause in just a moment, but let me get to a few more of your questions and comments. Jennifer in Alabama writes, I support the idea of leveling the playing field for children born into low-income families, but I'm afraid the data show that by 18 years old, education gaps, health disparities, and other disadvantages already disrupt our society. All families need a stable minimum income while they're raising their children to address crucial developmental needs. Americans need to realize this is in all our best interests and lose the attitude that their taxes shouldn't go to help someone else. Professor Hamilton, we have to pause in just a moment, but what about the interior of Jennifer's comment about the other factors that bear on a young person? Clearly, not every young person is going to be equally equipped to use that asset building money at age 18. Is there more that needs to be done around these so-called baby bonds to prep kids, briefly?
We could certainly accompany the program with various financial literacy programs in grade school for everyone. But the notion that differences in the ability to manage one's finances is a source of inequality doesn't always bear out by the data. The statistic that I like to quote is the fact that for black families where the head graduated from college, their typical net wealth position is lower than that of white families where the head dropped out of high school. So clearly, education in and of itself will not solve inequality in our country.
A lot of mixed opinions on whether we should be spending our money on other people's children. Raymond wrote on our Facebook page, if you can't afford a car, don't buy it. You can't afford children, you double down, have another, and expect the government to bail you out. And Adam cuts right to the chase. He wrote, can't feed them, don't breed them. Are Americans willing to pay for other kids to succeed? Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program on what's going around. Does it seem like everyone is getting sick this winter? I can relate, believe me, but it's not just anecdotal. Flu cases are indeed up, according to the CDC. What are you noticing where you are about what's going around this winter? If more people around you are getting sick, what's making them sick? And how are they dealing with it? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. I really hope you're staying well and not dealing with whatever the heck it is that I'm dealing with. And if you are, what are you doing to try to keep from getting sick this winter? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. I will try not to cough too much as we share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our discussion about the feasibility of so-called baby bonds in the U.S. with Véronique de Rougy, Professor Derek Hamilton, and Professor Michael Sheradin. Love to hear more of your questions and comments as well. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get to a few more of your comments before we keep going with our panel. Marianne writes, this program would be 1,000 times more effective if each child had a mentor to help them along the way. I know from personal experience that kids who come from families that have never had money need help to understand money. More importantly, these children need cheerleaders to give them emotional support as they try to move up the economic ladder. So often, a small setback that we would not see as a problem seems insurmountable to someone who does not have the confidence to know that things can be better. Andy tweeted, I would think that simply knowing that the money was coming at age 18 would allow a child and their family to grow up with a sense of hope. Imagine how valuable that would be. Professor Sheradin, let me come back to you. We'll get more into the practical aspect of this in just a minute, but what kind of evidence do we have for the effectiveness of these so-called baby bonds? You've done some long-term studies in the past, and you've been following this for quite some time. Do these so-called baby bonds even work?
I really liked Anthony's comment about hope, and the evidence seems to support that idea. So as a quick summary, we're running a very scientific experiment. We know and we can say with some confidence, and these results are published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, that if you set up a baby bond system, if that's the language we're using, and you put even $1,000 in it, doesn't have to be $20,000, we know that the families themselves will begin to save more into that account. We know that the educational expectations of the parents will increase. And we also know that's very much associated with educational achievement later on. We know the outlooks of the parents become more positive. We have measurable positive social development of the children in the early ages ahead of school. We have some evidence that parenting practices become more positive and less punitive in that process, and we know that the families have less economic hardship. So this is, I guess what I would like to say about a policy system like this is that you can very efficiently and build off of an existing, we're using the 529 college savings plan structure. Structure exists, you don't have to rebuild it. You can just adapt it to serve the whole population, which would be a very positive thing to do, and that the kids and the families are going to be better off even with relatively small investments. So it's a policy idea that you can put in place, and then you could begin, if you choose, to put mentoring and supplemental education, other things on top of that. But just having that account, as Anthony said in his comment, does make a difference.
I don't know why when you just said 529, the clouds just lifted for me, Professor Sherrod. Like, oh, those, yeah, like when I was growing up, we had Florida prepaid college program. You put a little money in and you can spend that at a state university once you turn 18. Professor Hamilton, is this kind of a version of a 529 plan? I wonder if it's that, or are you talking about building something new?
You have the option to spend the account on college tuition if you so desire, but you also have the option to spend it on other things as well. The idea is really to empower people. Some of the comments that were mentioned earlier have a lot to do with notions of how do we manage poor people to make better decisions. Well, that's perhaps the wrong way of thinking about poverty in any way. All the hope, all the financial literacy in the world is irrelevant if you have no finances to manage in the first place. The real issue around poverty is an endowment issue. And I think we need to really think about changing the way in which we address poverty from one of managing poor people, but rather empowering them so that they can make truly have choices and freedom. And wealth becomes a really good concept to hone in on that, because it's wealth itself that begets more wealth. So if people want to use their account towards financing a debt-free college education, that should be at their disposal. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if somebody wants to give it a shot at opening their own business, then they should have that opportunity with some seed capital. And again, it's not a handout, because you're not simply getting the money. Rather, you're just getting some chip to play in the game of capitalism, some opportunity to build more capital. And if you don't have that chip to begin with, all you're being is locked out of the system and locked into a low level of economic opportunity.
So, Professor Hamilton, I want to make this even clearer. You said you were just giving young people a chip to play with. So it's not like when you turn 18, we say, happy 18th birthday, here's $35,000. We say, happy 18th birthday, congratulations for getting accepted to the University of Miami. Tell me where to send your $35,000 check for your education. Is that it?
Yeah, I tried to use the metaphor of a game to hone in on the point, but perhaps that's not the best metaphor.
No. I actually think it is a good metaphor, because a chip has a cash value, but it's not cash. It's redeemable for something.
That's right. And that is what I intended to indicate.
Gotcha.
That you just have, if you don't have that chip to begin with, we know that you basically are othered and you just don't have opportunity.
Fair enough.
So, wealthy people have an opportunity with that chip. So we want all Americans to have an opportunity with that chip.
Véronique de Rougy, I wonder maybe if there is something to some of the comments about the wraparound services, like the comment we heard about mentoring. Maybe that's part of the debate over these baby bonds, that maybe just handing somebody this chip to play with might not be enough. One of our listeners kind of reflected that in her comment in our inbox.
My name is Pam. I'm calling from Colorado. I've been a high school counselor for 25 years. I believe education is fundamental to helping low-income students be lifted from poverty. What I've seen is that kids from low-income families miss school because the parents work 2 to 3 jobs and they have to stay home and do household things and take care of the kids. I've seen teenagers who are working 30 to 40 hours a week to help support their family. I've seen that health issues impact low-income families more, so they miss more school. They need the CHIP program, so they get health insurance. I feel like low-income kids, many of them are in neighborhoods with poor schools. Again, inequality. So if we're going to address income disparity, let's also address educational disparity.
Pam, thanks for calling in with that. Véronique, I wonder if maybe that becomes, in a political sense, more viable. Is it more that we need a kind of comprehensive inequality reform, and that this one piece would need to be coupled with other things to make it actually viable?
Well, I think everything, I mean, I agree with your caller, but everything about life and about policy decisions that we make is about trade-offs. So the question is, while there's no doubt that I'm sure the people receiving that money may enjoy it, there's a question about the long-term effect. Is there a way that actually, are there things that are more important that we must do? And when you look at the data put together at American University by Professor Tom Harris, he or Hyatt, sorry, and not a raging libertarian by any account, but when you look at the cause of income inequality, the factors, education accounts for 35%. And so 18 is too late already. So wouldn't that money be better spent earlier in life trying to address like one of the most fundamental cause of income inequality? Race accounts for 14%. Health, 8%. I mean, and that needs to be addressed earlier on. And at 18, you know, I mean, as a mom, I have to say the idea of just handing money, even in a control kind of a paternalistic environment to an 18-year-old seems like the worst thing we could do. Now, there may be a case for investing and encouraging savings that can be redeemed for retirement, because that's other issues and sources of inequality. But I think we need to be thinking about trade-off. And another trade-off, again, I hate to be, you know, the rainmaker, but it's just you're going to have to pay for this. Because yeah, I can go through the tax code and tell you all these things I would get rid of to get money to pay for this. I absolutely can. The political reality is quite different. So let's assume that the government is going to do what the government is going to do, which is usually it's just going to go on our credit card debt. This is going to be paid by higher taxes in the future.
When you describe, you said that as a mom, something about the idea felt paternalistic.
Right? I said even if you put paternalistic conditions on getting the money, I just don't think that 18 is like 18 seems like maybe the worst time to be handing money off to children. And that makes me the paternalistic person, okay. I guess, in the room.
Can you, well, hold on just 1 second before saying, I just want to expand on that just a little bit, because I'm interested in your perspective on this, and I'm not asking you to speak for all mothers.
Oh, no, no.
At all. But I'm kind of interested in your perspective on this as a mom. Just speaking for yourself, if you knew that this benefit was coming from the federal government, that this was something your child was entitled to, I presume you would have, your child would have the option to not take the money if they reached the age of 18 and they had been convinced they didn't want it. But expand on that. Talk through that as a mom a little bit further. I'm interested in your line of thought.
I mean, my personal experiences, like 18-year-olds don't seem the most responsible adult. They're adults yet, right? So, I would like to see data on the return that we get in terms of life income and investment of money handed to 18-year-old.
Professor Sherrod, and I assume it's two that we, do we know, or have the studies gone far enough to show whether or not these kinds of baby bonds actually create that return, or is it too soon to know?
It's too soon to know, but it's very clear that educational attainment is very much tied to income, which is very much tied to paying taxes. So I can predict with some confidence that if these accounts increase educational attainment, and so far the evidence looks like they do, that these will become stronger citizens, paying more taxes and be stronger members of the society.
It's interesting, Veronique, that you mentioned the maturity of an 18-year-old. GOP Granola tweeted, "The concept of a baby bond is interesting. However, we need to start recognizing neuroscience and realize the brain doesn't mature until 25. Giving it to 18-year-olds provides a future boom to the alcohol and cannabis industries, not improved lives. I could see an exception for education." By the way, we will be talking to NPR's Dina Temple-Raston tomorrow on a new podcast she's put together about the adult brain. You'll find that tomorrow on our website, the1a.org. One comment in particular got a really strong rise out of our audience. That thing I read earlier, Adam saying, if you can't feed them, don't breed them. Carolyn responded by email and wrote, "In response to if you can't feed them, don't breed them, what will you do when you're too old and you need them? Social Security requires a large base of well-paid younger people." And Jen in North Carolina added, "When I hear comments like that, I feel sad for this country and its children. Where is our sense of compassion and humility for the well-being and potential suffering of others? Without that sense of compassion as a fundamental value, I fear for our collective future. Taking care of our children should be at the core of our democracy."
Can I?
Professor Hamilton, because he's been waiting very patiently. Go ahead, Professor.
So let me jump in with a few points. First off, the metaphor of a game is useful, but has its limitations because it's certainly not a game. We're talking about life outcomes for people, so it's really serious. The notion about education, if we look at racial inequality, I think we can see, obviously, education is important. It's important in its own right, irrespective of its impact on the economic returns. We want people to have the ability to think and be able to make decisions. That should be a goal in and of itself. But we also know that if we look at black-white inequality, black people with higher levels of education still have twice the unemployment rate as white people with high levels of education. The unemployment gap remains persistent when we look at education. In fact, some disparities rise with education. Why is it that a black woman who has a college degree is more likely to have an infant mortality than a white woman who dropped out of high school? And again, why is it that black families where the head graduated from college only have two-thirds the wealth of white families where the head dropped out of high school? Education is important, but it's not a panacea, and inequality persists and actually increases with education. The idea of 18-year-olds, should we fund it to 18-year-olds? Me and my colleague Sandy are certainly open to extending the age of when you can receive the bond past 18 to when you're older. That's not a deal breaker for us. In fact, I have some concerns about 18 years old receiving the account also, largely because of predation from potentially colleges and universities, that they simply could increase their tuitions and absorb that entire account that's been endowed at birth.
One last question we got to get to. I know we're really, really low on time. Okay. There's a lot more discuss on this, but Professor Sharad, and I wonder if you could take Tim's question in Reston, Virginia, not far from here. Tim writes, why not take this idea all the way and offer universal basic income? What values do baby bonds add that a UBI would not do better?
Okay, that's a really good question. I could be in a positive discussion about universal basic income. I could also be in a more positive discussion about universal employment. So employment opportunities are offered to people. There's lots of public employment that could be created like we did in the New Deal. But I would say that building assets over a lifetime is distinctive and separate from that, because we actually have evidence that asset accumulation, controlling for income and controlling for other factors, creates positive outcomes in families.
That's Professor Michael Sharadin of Washington University in St. Louis and the Center for Social Development. Professor Sharadin, thanks for talking to us.
Great to be here.
Professor Derek Hamilton of the New School, a professor of economics. Thank you, Professor Hamilton.
Thank you.
And Véronique de Rougy, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Véronique, thank you.
Thank you.
Do send us your stories about who's getting sick this winter and how you're trying to stay well. 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.